voice in the darkness said, "Then increase the speed and find some daylight. It won't take too long." The world flashed. Suns flew across the sky, and soon time returned to normal. One stable sun illuminated the world. "Okay, I don't know how long this will last," the administrator said. The sun shone in the wilderness on a group of people, some familiar faces among them. King Wen of Zhou, Newton, von Neumann, Aristotle, Mozi, Confucius, and Einstein. Sparsely distributed, they faced Qin Shi Huang, who stood on a rock with a sword across his shoulders.
"I am not alone," he said. "This is the core leadership of Seven speaking."
"You shouldn't be talking about the new leadership before it's been finalized," someone said, and a clamor rose among the rest.
"Enough,"
Qin Shi Huang said, struggling to raise the sword.
"Setting aside the leadership controversy for the moment, we shall turn to more pressing matters. We all know of the launch of the Wallfacer Project, humanity's attempt to use closed-off, private strategic thinking to resist Sofon's surveillance. Since the Lord's transparent mind cannot possibly thread that labyrinth, humanity has regained its edge through this plan, and the four Wallfacers pose a threat to the Lord. In accordance with the resolution of the previous offline meeting, we must launch the Wall Breaker Project immediately."
At those last words, silence reigned, and no one voiced any objections. Then Qin Shi Huang said,
"We will appoint a wall breaker for each wall facer. Like the wall facers, the wall breakers will be authorized to tap all of the organization's resources, but their greatest resource will be the Sofons, which will render the wall facers' every action utterly exposed. The only secret will be their thoughts. The wall breakers' mission, then, is to analyze the wall facers' open and clandestine actions, with the help of the Sofons, and decipher the true nature of their strategic aims as early as possible. The leadership will now appoint the wall breakers."
Qin Shi Huang extended the sword, and, as if conferring knighthood, touched it to von Neumann's shoulder.
"You are the first wall breaker," he said. "You are Frederick Tyler's wall breaker."
Von Neumann knelt down and placed his left hand to his right shoulder in a salute.
"I accept the mission."
Qin Shi Huang touched the sword to Mozi's shoulder.
"You are the second wall breaker. You are Manuel Ray Diaz's wall breaker."
Mozi did not kneel, but stood straight and nodded haughtily.
"I will be the first to break a wall."
The sword touched Aristotle's shoulder.
"You are the third wall breaker. You are Bill Hines's wall breaker."
Aristotle did not kneel either, but shook his robe and said thoughtfully,
"Yes, I'm the only one who can break his wall."
Qin Shi Huang returned the sword to his own shoulder and swept his gaze across the crowd.
"Good. We now have wall breakers. You, like the wall facers, are the elite of the elite. The Lord be with you. Assisted by hibernation, you will start the long journey to the end of days, together with the wall facers."
"I don't think hibernation is necessary," Aristotle said. "I can complete the wall-breaker mission before we finish our normal lifespan."
Mozi nodded in agreement.
"When I break the wall, I will face my wall-facer in person, and I will savor how his spirit collapses in anguish and despair. Devoting the rest of my life to this is well worth it."
The final wall breaker likewise stated his intent to break their wall facers in person. Von Neumann said,
"We will unmask the last traces of every secret that humanity harbors from the Zophons. This is the final thing we can do for the Lord, for afterward, there will be no reason for us to exist."
"What about Luoji's wall breaker?"
someone asked. The question seemed to touch something in Qin Shi Huang's mind. He planted the sword into the ground and fell deep in thought. The sun suddenly sped up its descent to the earth, lengthening the shadows until they extended to the horizon. When it had set halfway, it abruptly changed direction and rose and fell a few times along the horizon, like the gleaming back of a whale cresting out of the black ocean, pulling the vast wilderness and the small group of people that made up this stark world back and forth between light and darkness.
Luoji is his own wall breaker. He needs to find out what threat he poses to the Lord,
Qin Shi Huang said.
Do we know whether or not he is a threat?
Someone asked.
I don't know, but the Lord knows, and Evans knew. Evans taught the Lord how to keep this secret, and he's dead. We can't know.
So, of all the wallfacers, is Luoji the greatest threat?
Someone hesitantly asked.
We don't know that either. Only one thing is clear,
Qin Shi Huang said, looking up at the canopy of the sky as it changed from blue to black.
Out of the four wallfacers, he is the only one in direct contest with the Lord.
Work Meeting, Space Force Political Department. Chang Wei-se stayed silent for a long while after opening the meeting, something he had never done before. He swept his eyes across the two rows of political officers at the conference table, then looked into the infinite distance while gently tapping his pencil on the tabletop, a light tapping that seemed to mark time for his thoughts. At last, he pulled himself out of his reverie.
Comrades, by an order announced yesterday by the Central Military Commission, I am now serving as commander of the Political Department of the Armed Forces. I accepted the appointment 1 week ago, but only now that we are seated together do I feel conflicted. I have suddenly realized that in front of me is the most beleaguered group of people in the Space Force, and now I am one of your number. I didn't realize this before, and for this I apologize to you.
He opened the document in front of him.
This portion of the meeting will be off the record. Comrades, let us have a candid exchange of views. Let us be Tri-Solarans for once, and open our thoughts to each other. This is crucial for our future work.
Chang Wei-se's gaze lingered on the face of each officer for a second or two, but they remained silent. Then he stood up and paced along the table behind the row of seated officers.
Our duty is to build in our forces the faith that we will be victorious in the future war. So, do we have that faith ourselves? Please raise your hands if you do. Remember, we are speaking our minds.
No one raised a hand. Nearly everyone was staring at the table. But Chang Wei-se noticed one man's gaze was fixed straight ahead. Zhang Beihai. He went on.
Do you believe that victory is possible? By possible, I mean not an accidental few tenths of a percent, but an actual, meaningful possibility.
Zhang Beihai raised a hand. His was the only hand raised.
First, let me thank all of you for your honesty, Chang Wei-se said, and then turned to Zhang Beihai. Excellent, Comrade Zhang. Tell us, on what do you base your confidence?
Zhang Beihai stood up, but Chang Wei-se motioned for him to sit down.
"This is not a formal meeting," he said. "It's just a heart-to-heart chat."
Still standing at attention, Zhang Beihai said,
"Commander, I can't answer your question sufficiently in just a few words, because building faith is a long and complicated process. First of all, I'd like to make note of the mistaken thinking among the troops at the present time. We all know that prior to the Trisolar Crisis, we had been advocating for the examination of the future of war from scientific and rational perspectives, and a powerful inertia has sustained this mentality, has sustained it to the present day. This is particularly the case in the present Space Force, where it has been exacerbated by the influx of a large number of academics and scientists. If we use this mentality to contemplate an interstellar war 4 centuries in the future, we'll never be able to establish faith in a victory."
"What Comrade Zhang Beihai says is peculiar," a colonel said. "Is steadfast faith not built upon science and reason? No faith is solid that is not founded on objective fact."
"Then let's take another look at science and reason. Our own science and reason, remember. The Trisolaran's advanced development tells us that our science is no more than a child collecting shells on the beach who hasn't even seen the ocean of truth. The facts we see under the guidance of our science and reason may not be the true objective facts. And since that's the case, we need to learn how to selectively ignore them. We should see how things change as they develop, and we shouldn't write off the future through technological determinism and mechanical materialism."
"Excellent," Chang Wei-se said, and nodded at him to continue. "We must establish faith in victory. A faith that is the foundation of military duty and dignity. When the Chinese military once faced a powerful enemy under extremely poor conditions, it established a firm faith in victory through a sense of responsibility to the people and the motherland. I believe that today, a sense of responsibility to the human race and to Earth civilization can encourage the same faith."
"But how are we supposed to go about specific ideological work?" asked an officer. "The Space Force is made up of complicated parts, which means that its ideology is complex. We've got our work cut out for us."
"I think that for the time being, at least, we should start with the mental condition of the troops," Zhang Beihai said.
"Big picture. Last week I visited troops from the Air Force and Naval Air Force that have just been brought under our branch, and I discovered that day-to-day training for these forces is incredibly slack. Small picture. Problems with military discipline are cropping up with increasing frequency. There was supposed to be a total switch to summer uniforms, but lots of people in headquarters are still wearing their winter uniforms. This state of mind must be changed as quickly as possible. Look, the Space Force is turning into an academy of sciences. Of course, we can't deny that its present mission is that of an academy of military sciences, but we ought to be conscious that we are an army, and we're an army in a state of war."
The conversation went on for a while longer, and then Chang Wei-se returned to his seat.
"Thank you. I hope that we will be able to continue having frank conversations. Now let's move on to the contents of the formal meeting."
As he spoke, he looked up and once again saw Zhang Beihai's steady gaze, which revealed a determination that warmed his heart a little. "Zhang Beihai, I know you have faith. With a father like that, it would be impossible for you not to. But things are definitely not as simple as you say. I don't know what you base your faith on, and I don't even know what else your faith encompasses. Just like your father. I admired him, but I have to admit
that in the end, I couldn't figure him out. Chong Wei-se flipped open the document in front of him.
Research on space warfare theory is in full swing at present, but one problem has already cropped up. The study of interplanetary warfare needs to be founded on a certain level of technological development, no doubt about it. But right now, basic research has only just begun, and technological breakthroughs will occur far in the future. This means our research has no support. Headquarters has revised the research plan in light of the circumstances, and has divided unified research on the theory of space warfare into three parts, to cater to the possible technological levels that the human world may reach in the future. Namely, a low-tech strategy, a mid-tech strategy, and a high-tech strategy. Work is currently in progress to define these three levels of technology, as well as to define a large number of index parameters in every major scientific discipline. But the core parameter will be the speed and range of a 10-kiloton class spaceship. The low-tech level. Spacecraft speed achieves 50 times the third cosmic velocity, or roughly 800 kilometers per second. Spacecraft are not equipped with life support. Under these conditions, the craft has a combat radius limited to the inner solar system, that is, within Neptune's orbit, or 30 AU from the Sun. The mid-tech level. Spacecraft speed achieves 300 times the third cosmic velocity, or 4,800 kilometers per second. Spacecraft are equipped with partial life support. Under these conditions, the combat radius of the craft extends beyond the Kuiper Belt and includes all space within 1,000 AU of the Sun. The high-tech level. Spacecraft speed achieves 1,000 times the third cosmic velocity, or 16,000 kilometers per second, which is 5% the speed of light. Spacecraft are fully equipped with life support. Under these conditions, the combat radius extends to the Oort cloud, with preliminary interstellar navigation capabilities. Defeatism is the greatest threat to the armed forces in space, so political and ideological workers will shoulder an extremely important responsibility in the Space Force. Political departments in the military will participate fully in the study of space warfare theory to eradicate the stain of defeatism and guarantee the correct direction of research. Those of you present today will become members of a space warfare theory task force. Although there will be some overlap among members of the three branches, the research institutions are independent and will tentatively be known as the Institute for Low-Tech Strategy, the Institute for Mid-Tech Strategy, and the Institute for High-Tech Strategy. At today's meeting, I'd like to hear from each of you which one you would choose, as a reference for the political department's next round of work appointments. Let's share our selections. Of the 32 political officers at the meeting, 24 selected low-tech, and 7 selected mid-tech. Just one officer chose high-tech, Zhang Beihai.
"Looks like Comrade Beihai wants to get into science fiction," someone said, to scattered laughter.
"My choice is the only hope for victory. That's the only level of technology that gives humanity any chance of building an effective defensive system for the Earth and solar system," Zhang Beihai said.
"We haven't even mastered controlled nuclear fusion. Sending a 10,000-ton warship to 5% of the speed of light? 10,000 times faster than the truck-sized spacecraft humanity has today? It's not even science fiction. It's fantasy."
"But don't we have 4 more centuries? We've got to keep potential progress in mind."
"But progress in fundamental physics is impossible."
"We haven't even tapped 1% of the potential applications of existing theories," Zhang Beihai said. "My feeling is that the biggest problem right now is the technology sector's approach to research. They're wasting too much time and money on low-end technology. In propulsion, for example, there's no reason at all to work on the fission drive. But right now, they're not only throwing huge amounts of R&D at it, they're even putting the same amount of effort into studying next-gen chemical propulsion. We should focus our resources on studying fusion engines and move directly to the development of media-free fusion engines, leapfrogging media-based fusion. The same problem exists in other areas of research. Sealed ecosystems, for instance, are a necessary technology for interstellar spacecraft that is not particularly dependent on fundamental theory, but research in this area is very limited. Chang Wei-se said,
"Comrade Zhang Beihai has posed at least one question worthy of attention. The military and scientific communities are all busy starting their own work, but there is insufficient communication among them. Fortunately, both sides are aware of the situation and are organizing a joint conference, and the military and the scientific communities have each established special agencies to strengthen communication between the two sides and establish a fully interactive relationship between space strategy and scientific research. The next step is to dispatch military representatives to the various research areas and to involve a large group of scientists in studying the theory of space warfare. Again, we can't sit and wait for technological breakthroughs. We ought to form our own ideological strategy as soon as possible and then promote it in every field. Next, I'd like to talk about another layer of relationships, that between the Space Force and the Wall Facers."
"The Wall Facers?" someone asked in wonder. "Are they going to interfere in Space Force work?"
"There's no sign of that at the moment, although Tyler has proposed paying an inspection visit to the military. But we ought to realize that they do have that power, and any interference that does take place may have unanticipated effects. We need to be mentally prepared for it. When such a situation does occur, we should maintain a balance between the Wall Facer project and mainstream defense."
After the meeting, Chang Wei-se sat alone in the empty conference room smoking a cigarette. The smoke wafted into a beam of sunlight shining through the window and seemed to catch fire. "Whatever happens, at least it's begun," he thought to himself. For the first time, Luoji felt that a dream had come true. He had imagined that Garanin was only boasting. Of course he could find a stunning, untouched place, but it was certain to be quite different from the place in his imagination. But when he got off the helicopter, it was like he had stepped into a dream world. The distant snow peaks, the lake in front of him, the grassy plain and forest beside the lake, all of it laid out exactly as he had sketched it for Garanin, and he hadn't dared permit himself to imagine such an immaculate environment. Everything seemed to have sprung out of a fairy tale. There was a slight sweetness to the fresh air, and even the sun seemed to be cautious, sending the softest and most exquisite part of its glow into this place. The most incredible thing was the small estate beside the lake and the villa at its heart. Kent, who was traveling with him, said the house was built in the mid-19th century, but it looked older, and the passage of time had made it blend in with its environment.
"Don't be surprised. Sometimes people dream of places that really exist," Kent said.
"Does anyone live here?" Luoji asked.
"No one in a 5-kilometer radius. Beyond that, there are a few small villages."
Luoji guessed that the place might be in northern Europe, but he didn't ask. Kent led him into the house. With his first glance at the spacious European-style living room, Luoji saw a fireplace, with fruitwood stacked neatly next to it that gave off a fresh fragrance.
"The former master of the house bids you welcome. He is proud to have a wall facer living here."
Kent went on to tell him
that the manor contained more than just the facilities he had requested. Stables with 10 horses, because the best way to get to the mountains was by walking and riding. A tennis court and a golf course. A wine cellar. And, on the lake, a motorboat and a few sailboats. Beneath its old exterior, the house had been fully modernized. Every room was equipped with a computer, broadband, and satellite television, and there was a digital projection room as well. In addition to all of this, Luoji had noticed a helipad when he arrived. It was clearly not built at the last minute.
The man's got money.
Not just money.
He doesn't want to disclose his identity, but you would probably recognize his name if I told you. He donated the land to the UN, a far larger gift than Rockefeller's. Just so you're clear, the land and all of the real estate on it belong to the UN. You only have right of residence. But you're not getting nothing. When the owner left, he said that he had taken away all of his personal belongings, and that whatever is left is yours. These paintings alone must be worth quite a bit. Kent took Luoji on a tour of every room in the house. He noticed that the original owner had good taste and had furnished every room with a sense of elegant tranquility. A considerable portion of the books in the library were old Latin editions. The paintings were mostly in the modernist style, but they did not seem out of place in rooms with a rich classical atmosphere. One thing in particular that struck him was the total absence of landscapes, the mark of a mature aesthetic sensibility. Hanging landscape paintings in a house situated in the Garden of Eden would be as pointless as pouring a bucket of water into the ocean. Returning to the living room, Luoji sat down on the deliciously comfortable chair in front of the fireplace. He stretched out his hand and brushed against an object, which he then picked up and inspected. A churchwarden pipe, the kind with a long, thin stem, used indoors by the leisure class. He looked toward the wall and its empty shelves and imagined what had been taken down. Then Kent came in and introduced a few people. The housekeeper, cook, driver, groom, and boatmaster, all of whom had been in the previous owner's service. When they had gone, Kent introduced him to a lieutenant colonel in civvies, who was responsible for security. After he left, Luoji asked Kent where Shi Qiang was. He's handed over your security detail and has probably returned home.
Let him take the place of that guy just now. I think he'll do a better job.
I feel the same way, but he doesn't speak English. It would be hard for him to do his job.
Then bring in Chinese guards to replace the ones here. Kent agreed and left to make the call. Luoji also left the room and walked across the manicured lawn onto a pier leading out into the middle of the lake. He held the railing at the end and gazed at the reflection of the snow caps in the lake's mirror surface. Surrounded by sweet air and sunshine, he said to himself, "Compared to life today, what does the world 4 centuries from now matter? Screw the Wallfacer project."
"How did that bastard get in?"
the researcher at the terminal said softly.
"Wallfacers are naturally free to enter,"
his neighbor answered quietly.
"It's pretty dull, isn't it? I expect you're disappointed, Mr. President."
Dr. Allen, director of the Los Alamos National Laboratory, said to Ray Diaz as he led him past the rows of computer terminals.
"I'm no longer president,"
Ray Diaz said severely as he surveyed his surroundings.
"This is our nuclear weapons simulation center. Los Alamos has 4 of these centers, and Lawrence Livermore has 3.
2 objects caught Ray Diaz's eye as being not entirely dull. They looked new, with large displays and consoles with lots of fine knobs. He headed over to take a closer look, but Allen pulled him back.
"That's a game machine. The terminals here aren't for gaming,
so we brought in two machines for relaxation. Ray Diaz noticed another two not entirely dull objects. Transparent and structurally complicated, they contained a bubbling liquid. Again, he started over to take a look, and this time Alan shook his head with a smile and did not stop him.
That one's a humidifier. The climate is dry in New Mexico. The other one's just a coffee machine. Mike, pour Mr. Ray Diaz a cup of coffee. No, wait, not from that. I'll brew you a cup of top shelf roast in my office.
The only thing left for Ray Diaz to do was to examine the blown-up black-and-white photographs hanging on the wall. He recognized the skinny man wearing a hat and smoking a pipe as Oppenheimer. Then Alan directed his attention back to the bland terminals.
These displays are obsolete, Ray Diaz said.
But behind them is the most powerful computer in the world, operating at 30 petaflops.
An engineer came up to Alan. Doctor, the AD-4453-OG is operational.
Excellent.
The engineer lowered his voice.
We've suspended the output module, he said, and glanced at Ray Diaz.
Run it, Alan said, then turned to Ray Diaz. See? We've got nothing to hide from the wall facers.
Then Ray Diaz heard tearing sounds and saw the people at the terminals ripping paper apart. Assuming that they were destroying documents, he muttered,
Don't you even have a shredder?
But then he noticed that they were tearing up blank copy paper. Then someone shouted,
Over!
And everyone cheered and tossed the shredded paper into the air, making the cluttered floor even more like a garbage dump.
This is a simulation center tradition. When the first atom bomb was exploded, Dr. Fermi tossed torn paper into the air, and according to the distance the pieces drifted in the shockwave, he was able to accurately compute the yield of the bomb. Now we do the same thing for every simulation we run.
Ray Diaz brushed the paper from his head and shoulders and said,
You run nuclear tests every day. But to you, it's as easy as playing a video game. It's not like that for us. We don't have supercomputers. We've got to do real tests. We do the same thing, but the poor always end up being the nuisance.
Mr. Ray Diaz, no one here is interested in politics.
Diaz leaned in to take a closer look at the terminals, but saw only scrolling data and shifting curves. When he finally did locate some graphics, they were so abstract he couldn't make anything out. When he leaned toward another terminal, the physicist seated in front of it looked up and said,
Mr. President, if you're looking for a mushroom cloud, it's not there.
I'm not the president,
Ray Diaz repeated as he accepted the coffee Mike handed him. Alan said,
Then we ought to talk about what we can do for you.
Design a nuclear bomb.
Of course. Los Alamos may be a multidisciplinary institution, but I suspected you wouldn't be here for any other reason. Can you give me any specifics? What type? What yield?
The PDC will send you the completed technical requirements before long, so I'll just brief you on the key points. Large yield, the largest possible, as large as you can make it. 200 megatons at an absolute minimum.
Alan stared at him for a moment, and then bent his head in thought.
That will require some time.
Don't you have mathematical models?
Of course we do. We have models for everything from 500-ton shells to large 20-megaton bombs, from neutron bombs to EMP bombs. But the explosive yield you're asking for is far too large. It's more than 10 times the world's largest thermonuclear device. It would have to have a totally different trigger and staging from a conventional nuclear weapon, and it might even require an entirely new structure. We don't have a model that fits.
They spoke some more about the general planning of various research projects, and when it came time to leave, Alan said,
Mr. Ray Diaz,
I know you have the best physicists on your staff at the PDC. I assume they've told you about the applications of nuclear weapons to space warfare.
You're permitted to be redundant.
Very well. In space warfare, nuclear bombs may be low-efficiency weapons, since nuclear explosions produce no shockwave in the vacuum of space, and only negligible pressure from the light they generate, so they don't produce the mechanical impact found in explosions in the atmosphere. All their energy is released in the form of radiation and electromagnetic pulses, and, at least for humans, radiation and EM shielding on spacecraft is a fairly mature technology.
And if the target is directly hit?
That's a different thing altogether. In that case, heat will be a decisive factor, and the target may be melted or even vaporized. But one bomb of a few hundred million tons will probably be as big as a building, so I'm afraid it won't be easy to score a direct hit. In fact, the mechanical impact of nuclear weapons doesn't measure up to kinetic weapons. Their radiation is less intense than particle beam weapons, and their thermal destruction can't compare to gamma-ray lasers.
But those weapons aren't combat-ready. Nuclear bombs are humanity's most powerful mature weapons. And as for the performance issues you mention in space combat, ways can be found to improve them. Adding a medium to create a shockwave, for example, like putting ball bearings in a grenade.
That's an intriguing idea. Your STEM background shows through.
My studies were in nuclear energy, which is why I like nuclear bombs. I've got a good feeling about them.
Alan laughed. I almost forgot. It's ridiculous to discuss issues like this with a wall facer. The two men laughed, but Ray Diaz quickly grew serious and said,
Dr. Alan, like everyone else, you're treating the wall-facer strategy as something mysterious. The most powerful combat-ready weapon available to mankind right now is the hydrogen bomb. Focusing on that is only natural, isn't it? I believe my approach is the correct one.
The two men stopped on the quiet path through the woods they had been walking along. Alan said, Fermi and Oppenheimer walked down this road countless times. After Hiroshima and Nagasaki, most of the architects of the first generation of nuclear weapons spent the rest of their lives mired in depression. They would be gratified if they knew the mission that humanity's nuclear weapons are now facing.
No matter how frightening they might be, weapons are a good thing. Just to let you know, the next time I come, I hope I won't see you throwing scrap paper around. We should make a tidy impression on the Sophons.
Keiko Yamasuki woke up in the middle of the night to find herself alone, the sheets beside her cool. She got up, dressed, and went out the door. At first glance, she saw her husband's shadow in the bamboo grove in the yard, as usual. They had homes in England and in Japan, but Heinz preferred his Japanese home. He said that the moonlight of the east calmed his heart. There was no moon tonight. The bamboo and his kimono-clad figure lost their dimensionality and looked like paper cuttings hung beneath the stars. Heinz heard Keiko Yamasuki's footsteps, but did not look back. Strangely, Keiko wore the same shoes in England as in Japan. Even in her hometown, she never wore a geta. But it was only here, never in England, that he could hear her footsteps.
My love, you haven't slept properly for days, she said.
Her voice was soft, but the summer insects stopped chirping, and peace flooded like water over everything. She heard her husband sigh.
Keiko, I can't do it. I can't think of anything. Really, I can't come up with anything at all.
No one can. I say an ultimate victory plan doesn't exist.
She took two steps forward, but was still separated from Heinz by a few stalks of bamboo. The grove was their place for contemplation, and the inspiration for most of their previous research had its source here. They rarely brought intimacy to this sacred place, but always addressed each other courteously, as befitted an atmosphere seemingly imbued with Eastern philosophy.
Bill, you should relax. Doing the best you can is enough.
He turned around, but in the darkness of the grove, his face was indistinct.
How is that possible? Every step I take consumes a massive amount of resources.
Then why not adopt this approach?
Keiko's answer came swiftly. She had obviously been thinking about the question.
Choose a direction that, even if you're unsuccessful, will do something beneficial while it is being carried out.
Keiko, that's exactly what I've been thinking about. Here's what I've decided to do. Even if I can't come up with a plan, I can help other people think of one.
What other people? The other wallfacers?
No, they're not much better off than I am. I mean our descendants. Keiko, have you ever considered this fact? The outcome of natural biological evolution requires at least 20,000 years to manifest itself. But human civilization has just 5,000 years of history, and modern technological civilization just 200. That means that the study of modern science today is being done by the brain of primitive man.
You want to use technology to accelerate the brain's evolution?
We've been doing brain research, and we ought to put more effort into expanding it to a scale that can tackle a planetary defense system. If we work hard for a century or two, we might be able to increase human intelligence and allow the science of the future to break out of the Sophon's prison.
Intelligence is a vague term in our field. What in particular?
I mean intelligence in the broadest sense of the word. Not just the traditional meaning of logical reasoning, but learning ability, imagination, and innovation as well. And also, the ability to accumulate common sense and experience while preserving intellectual vigor, and enhancing mental endurance so that a brain can think continuously without fatigue. And we can even consider the possibility of eliminating sleep, and so forth.
What will it take? Do you even have a rough idea?
No, not yet. Perhaps the brain can be connected directly to a computer, which can use its computing power to amplify human intelligence. Or maybe we can achieve a direct interface between human brains and blend different people's thoughts, or inherit memories. But whatever avenue we ultimately take to increase human intelligence, we must first begin from a fundamental understanding of the mechanisms of the human brain.
And that's precisely our area of interest.
We can continue in the same career as before. The difference will be that we can tap huge resources to do it.
Love, I'm truly happy. I'm ecstatic. There's just one thing. As a wallfacer, don't you think this plan is a little indirect?
Maybe. But think about it, Keiko. Human civilization ultimately comes down to humans themselves. If we start by elevating humans, doesn't that make this a far-reaching plan? Besides, what else can I do?
Bill, you're wonderful.
So think about this for a moment. If we turn neuroscience and thought research into a world engineering project and can invest an inconceivably enormous amount of money in it, how long will we have to wait for success?
About a century, more or less.
Let's be a little more pessimistic and say 2 centuries. Then, the highly intelligent humans will still have 2 centuries left, and if they use 1 century to develop fundamental science and another to turn those theories into technology.
Even if it fails, we'll have done what we wanted to do.
Keiko,
come with me to the end of days,
Heinz murmured.
Yes, Bill. We certainly have the time.
The insects in the grove seemed to have grown accustomed to their presence and resumed their musical chirping. When a soft wind blew through the bamboo and the stars in the night sky flashed through the gaps between the leaves, it was as if the insect chorus was issuing from those stars. It was day 3 of the PDC's first Wallfacers Project hearing. Tyler, Ray Diaz, and Heinz had spoken about the first phase of their respective projects, which were put to preliminary discussion by representatives of the PDC permanent members. Ray Diaz and Heinz had both submitted their plans at the previous hearing, but Tyler had delayed his first disclosure until this session, leaving representatives particularly eager for details. Tyler started with a brief introduction.
I need to establish an armed force in space that will supplement Earth's fleet, but be under my command.
Just one sentence in, the hands of the other two wallfacers shot up.
Mr. Heinz and I have been accused of overuse of resources in our plans,
Ray Diaz broke in.
But this is absurd. Mr. Tyler wants to have his own space force.
I didn't say it was a space force,
Tyler said calmly.
The intent is not to construct warships or large spaceships, but to establish a fleet of space fighters. They'll each be roughly the size of a conventional Earth-based fighter, and will carry a single pilot. They'll be like mosquitoes in space, so I've dubbed this the Mosquito Swarm Plan. The formation needs to be at least equal to the size of the invading Trisolaran fleet. 1,000 ships.
You would attack a Trisolaran warship with a mosquito? That's not even going to raise a welt,
a hearing member said dismissively. Tyler raised a finger.
Not if each of those mosquitoes is equipped with 100-megaton class hydrogen bomb. So I'm going to need the latest superbomb technology. Don't turn me down immediately, Mr. Ray Diaz. You can't turn me down, in fact. According to the principles of the Wallfacer Project, that technology isn't your proprietary property. Once it's been developed, I have the right to requisition it.
Ray Diaz glanced up at him.
My question is, do you intend to plagiarize my plan?
Tyler smiled sardonically.
If a Wallfacer's plan can be copied, is he still a Wallfacer?
Mosquitoes can't fly very far,
said Garanin, the PDC rotating chair.
These toy space fighters can only engage in combat within the orbit of Mars, I believe.
Watch out! His next request might be for a space carrier,
Heinz said with a chuckle. Tyler answered with aplomb.
That will be unnecessary. These space fighters can link up via a network to turn the entire squadron into a single entity, a mosquito group, that acts as a space carrier and is propelled by an external engine, or by the engine of a small portion of its member fighters. At cruising speed, the group will possess the long-range space navigation capabilities of large spacecraft. Once it reaches the battlefield, the huge entity will disassemble and go into battle as a fleet of independent fighters.
Your mosquito group will take years to reach the defensive zone at the perimeter of the solar system. A fighter pilot can't spend such a long journey in a cockpit that doesn't even permit them to stand up. Will there even be room for supplies in such a small craft?
Someone asked.
Hibernation, Tyler said. They'll have to hibernate. My plan relies on the realization of two technologies: miniaturized superbombs and miniaturized hibernation units.
Hibernating for a few years in a metal coffin, then waking up, only to launch a suicide attack. Clearly, the job of a mosquito pilot is not one to be envied,
Heinz said. Tyler's enthusiasm disappeared, and he remained silent for a moment. Then he nodded.
Yes,
Finding pilots is the hardest part of the mosquito swarm plan. My next step is to do some research to figure out how to overcome it. Details of Tyler's plan were distributed to the members of the hearing, but there was no interest in discussion. The chair declared the hearing adjourned. "Luoji still hasn't arrived?" asked the annoyed U.S. representative.
"He won't be coming," said Garanin. "He declared that his seclusion and non-participation in the PDC hearing is part of his plan."
At this, the attendees whispered among themselves. Some of them seemed annoyed, while others flashed cryptic smiles.
"He's a deadbeat, a waste," Ray Diaz said.
"Then what are you?" Tyler asked rudely, even though his mosquito swarm plan relied on Ray Diaz's super hydrogen bomb technology. Hines said,
"I'd rather express my regard for Dr. Luo. He knows himself and knows his own abilities, so he doesn't want a pointless waste of resources."
He turned graciously to Ray Diaz.
"I think Mr. Ray Diaz should learn something from him."
Everyone could see that Tyler and Hines were not defending Luoji, but that their enmity toward Ray Diaz was far deeper by comparison. Garanin rapped the gavel on the table.
"First of all, Volfacer Ray Diaz has spoken out of order. I remind you to show respect to the other Volfacers. Similarly, I remind Volfacers Hines and Tyler that your words are also inappropriate for this meeting."
Hines said,
"Mr. Chair, what Volfacer Ray Diaz has demonstrated in his plan is nothing but the crudeness of a soldier. Following in the footsteps of Iran and North Korea, his country fell under UN sanctions because of its nuclear weapons program, and this has given him a twisted complex for the bomb. There is essentially no difference between Mr. Tyler's mosquito swarm program and Ray Diaz's giant hydrogen bomb plan. Both are disappointments. The two straightforward plans will have their strategic intent exposed right from the start. Neither exhibits the canniness that's the strategic advantage of the Wallfacer project."
Tyler shot back. "Mr. Hines, your plan is like some sort of naive daydream." When the hearing ended, the Wallfacers went to the meditation room, their favorite place in UN headquarters. It now seemed to them that this room designed for silence was built especially for Wallfacers. Gathered there, they waited in silence, each of them feeling that they would never be able to exchange thoughts until the final war came. The slab of iron ore lay silently in their midst, as if absorbing and collecting their thoughts and silently bearing witness. Hines said softly,
"Have you heard about the wall breakers?"
Tyler nodded. "The ATO just announced it on their public website, and it's been verified by the CIA. The Wallfacers lapsed into silence again, each one conjuring in his mind an image of his own wallbreaker. It was an image that would appear countless times in their nightmares, for the day a wallbreaker actually appeared would likely spell the end of that Wallfacer. When Shi Xiaoming saw his father enter, he edged toward the corner, but Shi Qiang simply sat down quietly next to him.
"Don't be afraid. I won't hit you or curse at you this time. I don't have the energy."
He brought out a pack of cigarettes, took out two, and offered one to his son. Shi Xiaoming hesitated before accepting it. They lit up and smoked for a while in silence. Then Shi Qiang said,
"I've got a mission. I'll be leaving the country soon."
"What about your illness?"
Shi Xiaoming looked up through the smoke and gave his father a worried look.
"Let's talk about you first."
Shi Xiaoming's expression turned pleading.
"Dad, there's going to be a heavy sentence for this."
"Any other crime, and I'd be able to work it out for you. But that's not how this is going to work. Ming, we're both adults. We need to be responsible for our actions."
Shi Xiaoming bowed his head in despair,
and took a silent draw on his cigarette. Shi Qiang said,
I'm half to blame. I never had any concern for you when you were growing up. I came home late every night, so tired I'd just have a drink and then go to bed. I never went to a parents' meeting at school, and I never had a good talk with you about anything. It's the same thing again. We have to be responsible for our own actions.
Tears in his eyes, Shi Xiaoming ground the cigarette back and forth repeatedly on the edge of the bed, like he was extinguishing the latter half of his life.
Prison is like a criminal training course. Forget about reform when you go in. Just don't get mixed up with the other prisoners. And learn how to protect yourself a little. Take these.
Shi Qiang placed a plastic bag on the bed. Inside were two cartons of ordinary Yunnan cigarettes.
And if you need anything else, your mother will send it to you.
Shi Qiang went to the door, then turned and said to his son,
Ming, you may still meet your dad again. You'll probably be older than me at that point, and then you'll understand what's in my heart right now.
Through the small window in the door, Shi Xiaoming watched his father exit the detention center. From the back, he looked quite old. In an era where anxiety had taken hold of everything, Luoji was now the world's most laid-back man. He strolled beside the lake, took a boat out into the water, had the chef turn the mushrooms he picked and the fish he caught into tasty delicacies, browsed through the library's rich collection, and when he tired of that, went outside and golfed with the guards. He rode on horseback through the grassland and on the forest path in the direction of the snow peak, but he never reached the foot of the mountain. Oftentimes, he would sit on a bench on the lakeside and look at the mountain's reflection in the water, doing and thinking nothing as an entire day passed unknowingly. He was alone during this time, with no connection to the outside world. Kent was in the manor, too, but he had his own small office and rarely bothered him. Luoji had only spoken once to the officer in charge of security, to ask that the security detail not trail along behind him, and if they absolutely had to make sure that he could not see them. He felt like the boat in the water, floating quietly with its sail furled, ignorant of where it was moored, and not caring where it floated. Now and then, when he thought about his former life, he was surprised to discover that in the short space of a few days, he could no longer recognize it. This state satisfied him. He was particularly interested in the wine cellar. He knew that the dust-covered bottles lying horizontally on the racks held nothing but the best. He drank in the living room, he drank in the library, and sometimes he drank on the boat, but never too much. Just enough to keep him in that perfect, half-drunk, half-sober state, and then he would take out that long-stemmed pipe left by the previous owner and puff away. Even when it rained and the living room grew chilly, Luoji never had the fireplace lit. He knew it wasn't yet time. He never went online here, but he sometimes watched television, skipping over the news and watching programs that had nothing to do with current events, or even the present day. This sort of content was still possible to find, although it was growing increasingly rare in the last ebbs of the Golden Age. Late one night, he got carried away by a bottle of cognac that, from the label, was 35 years old. Wielding the remote, he skipped past the several news stations on the high-definition television, but one English-language news item caught his eye. It concerned the salvage of a mid-17th-century wreck, a clipper that had sailed from Rotterdam to Faridabad and had sunk off Cape Horn. Among the objects that divers had retrieved from the wreck was a small sealed cask of fine wine that experts speculated was still drinkable. Not only that, but after 3 centuries in storage at the bottom of the ocean, its taste would be unparalleled. Luoji recorded most of the program and then called for Kent.
"I want that cask. Buy it for me," he said.
Kent went to make a call. 2 hours later, he told Luoji that the price of the cask was astonishingly high. Bidding would start at 300,000 euros.
"That amount is nothing to the Wallfacer project. Buy it. It's part of the plan."
And thus, the Wallfacer project produced a second idiom after the Wallfacer smile. Anything that was clearly absurd, but which had to be done anyway, was called part of the Wallfacer plan, or simply, part of the plan. 2 days later, the cask, its aged surface covered in shells, was placed in the villa's living room. Luoji took out a tap with a twist drill specially made for wooden casks, which he found in the cellar, and carefully drilled it into the side to pour out the first glass. The liquid was a tempting emerald green. He sniffed it, and then put the glass to his lips.
"Doctor, is this part of the plan too?"
Kent asked softly.
"That's right. It's part of the plan."
Luoji was about to drink, but seeing the people present in the room, he said,
"All of you, out."
Kent and the rest of them did not move.
"Sending you out is part of the plan, too. Out!"
He glared at them. Kent gently shook his head and led the others out. Luoji took a sip. Although he did his utmost to convince himself that the flavor was heavenly, in the end, he did not have the guts to take a second sip. But that one sip didn't let him go unscathed. That night, he was sick out both ends, until he spat up bile the color of the wine, and his body was so weak he couldn't get out of bed. Later, after doctors and experts opened the cask lid, they found that it had a rather large brass label on the inside wall, as was the custom in those days. Over time, there had been some sort of reaction between the normally peacefully coexisting copper and the wine, and some sort of substance had dissolved into the wine. When the cask was carried off, Luoji could see the schadenfreude on Kent's face. Deeply exhausted, he lay in bed watching his IV drip, and an intense loneliness seized him. He knew that his recent leisure was merely the weightlessness of tumbling into the abyss of loneliness, and now he had reached the bottom. But he had anticipated this moment, and he had been prepared. He was waiting for someone, and then the next step of the plan would begin. He was waiting for Da Shi. Tyler stood holding an umbrella against the Kagoshima drizzle. Behind him, 2 meters away, stood Defense Chief Koichi Inoue, whose umbrella remained unopened. The past 2 days he had maintained the same separation from Tyler, both physically and mentally. They were at the Chiron Peace Museum for kamikaze pilots, and in front of them was a statue of a special attack unit next to a white plane, call sign 502. A light layer of rain painted the surface of the statue and the aircraft, and made them deceptively lifelike.
"Isn't there any room for discussion of my proposal?" Tyler asked.
"I strongly advise you not to speak of this to the media. It will cause trouble."
Koichi Inoue's words were as icy as the rain.
"Is it still that sensitive? Even today?"
"What's sensitive isn't the history, but your proposal to restore the kamikaze special attack units. Why don't you do it in the U.S. or some other place? Are the Japanese people the only ones in the world who can die out of duty?"
Tyler closed up his umbrella and drew closer to Koichi Inoue, who, although he didn't recoil, seemed to have a force field surrounding him that prevented Tyler from getting close.
"I've never said that the future kamikaze forces would be made up only of Japanese members. It's an international force, but since it originated in your great country, isn't it only natural to revive it here?"
"In interplanetary war, does this mode of attack
really have any significance. You should realize that victories for those special attack units were limited, and they didn't turn the tide of battle.
Commander, sir, the Space Force I have established is a fleet of fighters equipped with super hydrogen bombs.
Why do you need humans? Can't computer-controlled fighters get close enough to attack?
This question seemed to give Tyler the opportunity he was waiting for, and he grew excited.
That's exactly the problem. Today's computers are unable to replace human brains, and advancements in fundamental theory would be necessary for quantum and other next-gen computers. But that's been locked up by the Sophons. So 4 centuries from now, computing intelligence will still be limited, and human-controlled weapons will be indispensable. To tell you the truth, reviving the kamikaze squads only has moral significance now, because it will be 10 generations before any of them go to their death. But establishing that spirit and faith means starting now.
Koichi Inoue turned around to face Tyler for the first time. His wet hair was plastered against his forehead, and the raindrops on his face looked like tears.
That approach violates the basic moral principles of modern society. Human lives come first, and the state and the government can't require any individual to take up a death mission. I seem to remember a line Yang Wenli said in Legend of the Galactic Heroes. In this war lies the fate of the country. But what does it matter next to individual rights and freedoms? All of you, just do your best.
Tyler sighed. You know what? You have thrown away your most precious resource. Then he snapped open his umbrella and turned and walked angrily away. When he reached the gate of the memorial, he looked back and saw Koichi Inoue still standing in the rain before the statue. As Tyler walked in the sea breeze, his mind returned to a sentence from a suicide note from a kamikaze pilot to his mother that he had seen in the exhibit. Mom, I'm going to be a firefly.
It's worse than I imagined, Alan said to Ray Diaz.
They were standing next to a black obelisk made of lava rock, the monument marking ground zero of humankind's first atom bomb.
Is its structure really that different? Ray Diaz asked.
Totally different from today's nuclear bombs. Constructing its mathematical model might be more than 100 times more complicated than today's bombs. This is an enormous undertaking.
What do I need to do?
Cosmo's on your staff, right? Get him to come to my lab.
William Cosmo?
Yes.
But he's...
he's... an astrophysicist. An authority on stars.
What's he going to do?
That's what I'm going to tell you. To your mind, a nuclear bomb is detonated and then explodes. But the actual process is more like burning. The greater the yield, the longer the combustion. A 20-megaton nuclear explosion, for example, has a fireball that can last for over 20 seconds. The super bomb we're designing is 200 megatons, and its fireball will burn for several minutes. Think about that. What will it look like?
A small sun.
Correct. Its fusion structure is very like that of a star, and it reproduces stellar evolution over a very abbreviated period. So the mathematical model we need to construct is essentially the model of a star.
White sands stretched out in front of them. In the moments just before dawn, the details of the dark desert couldn't be made out. As they gazed at the scenery, they were involuntarily reminded of the basic setting of Three Body.
I'm very excited, Mr. Ray Diaz. Please forgive me for our lack of enthusiasm at the start. Looking at the project now, the significance far exceeds the construction of a super bomb itself. Do you know what we're doing?
We're creating a virtual star.
Ray Diaz shook his head in disapproval.
What does that have to do with the defense of Earth?
Don't be limited by planetary defense. Me and my colleagues in the lab are scientists, after all. Besides, this thing is not without practical significance. So long as you input the appropriate parameters, the star could be a model for our sun. Think about it. It's always useful to have the sun in your computer memory. It's the biggest presence that's close to us in the cosmos, but we could take more advantage of it. The model may have many more discoveries lying in wait.
Ray Diaz said,
One previous use of the sun is what brought humanity to the brink and brought you and me to this place.
But new discoveries might bring humanity back. So today, I've invited you here to watch the sunrise. The rising sun was just now peeking its head over the horizon. The desert in front of them came into focus like a developing photograph, and Ray Diaz could see that this place, once blasted by the fires of hell, was now covered in sparse undergrowth.
I am become death, destroyer of worlds, Alan exclaimed.
What?
Ray Diaz whipped his head around, as if someone had shot him from behind.
Oppenheimer said that when he watched the first nuclear explosion. I think it's a quote from the Bhagavad Gita.
The wheel in the east expanded rapidly, casting light across the earth like a golden web. The same sun was there on that morning when Ye Wenjie had turned the red shore antenna. And even before that, the same sun had shone upon the dust settling after the first bomb blast. Australopithecus 1 million years ago, and the dinosaurs 100 million years ago, had turned their dull eyes upon this very sun. And even earlier than that, the hazy light that penetrated the surface of the primeval ocean and was felt by the first living cell was emitted by this same sun.
Alan went on. And then a man called Bainbridge followed up Oppenheimer's statement with something completely non-poetic. Now, we are all sons of bitches.
What are you talking about?
Ray Diaz said. Watching the rising sun, his breathing became ragged.
I'm thanking you, Mr. Ray Diaz, because from now on, we're not sons of bitches.
In the east, the sun rose in overarching solemnity, as if declaring to the world, Everything is as fleeting as a shadow before me.
What's the matter, Mr. Ray Diaz?
Alan saw that Ray Diaz had fallen into a crouch, one hand on the ground, and was convulsing in dry heaves. His face had turned pale and was covered in a cold sweat, and he had no strength to move his hand from the clump of thorns it was pressing on.
Go! Go to the car! He said weakly.
He turned his head in the direction opposite the sun, and he raised his other hand to block the sunlight. He was unable to get up. Alan tried to assist, but couldn't budge his stocky body.
Drive the car over!
Ray Diaz wheezed out, while pulling his hand back to cover his eyes. When Alan drove over to him, he had fallen to the ground. With difficulty, Alan helped him into the back seat.
Sunglasses! I need sunglasses!
He half reclined into the back seat, his hands clawing at the air. Alan handed Ray Diaz a pair of sunglasses he found on the dashboard. After he put them on, his breathing grew smoother.
I'm all right. Let's get out of here. Quickly,
he said feebly.
What on earth happened? What's wrong?
It might be the sun.
When did you start having this sort of reaction?
Just now.
The peculiar phobia for the sun that afflicted Ray Diaz pushed him to the edge of mental and physical breakdown whenever he saw it, and kept him confined indoors from then on.
Was the flight very long? You look like you don't have any energy,
was the first thing Luoji said after Shi Qiang arrived.
Yeah. You'll never find a plane as comfortable as the one we were on, Shi Qiang said as he appraised his surroundings. Not bad, eh?
It's awful, Shi Qiang said, shaking his head. Woods on three sides, so it's easy to hide close to the house. And there's a lake. With the shore this close to the house, it would be difficult to defend against divers coming from the woods on the other side. But the surrounding grassland is pretty good, and provides some open space.
Can't you be any more romantic?
I'm here to work, my boy.
It's romantic.